So the four Brahma Viharas again are these four qualities that are in some way, they're like one bundle, they're one package. They certainly could be talked about separately, and they often are, but they're very, very connected to one another. The word Brahma meaning celestial or supreme, Vihara meaning home or abiding or dwelling. So taken together, they form that kind of supreme home. The first is loving kindness, which we've talked about a lot. The second is compassion, which will, thank you so much, will begin to discuss more in depth. Compassion is known as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's an actual movement of the heart, and it's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. The third quality is sympathetic joy, which means joy in the happiness of others. So instead of feeling so overcome by jealousy or envy, when we see someone's success or good fortune, we're actually happy for them. And equanimity, which is the last, or sometimes talked about first, is the voice of wisdom. It means that we're bringing some wisdom into the situation. And the particular manifestation of wisdom is balance. It's like having perspective on something. You know, when you feel really caught or really clumsy, it's very different than when you have kind of a more spacious view about things, because in that spacious view, maybe you can admit, you know what, I don't know right now how this will all end up, but the not knowing itself is kind of a relief rather than being so freaked out because it didn't work out right away. Or realizing the limits, the boundaries we actually have in terms of control. Like, maybe the equanimity joins with our compassion in that I will do everything I can to try to help, and I can have the wisdom, the understanding that in the end, it's not up to me how you live your life. Would that it were, you know, but it's not. So equanimity is the bringing forth of wisdom in the form of balance or perspective into some situation. So there are two different models to look at. One I talked about yesterday, and that is understanding in terms of action. We talk about first the motivation or the intention behind an action. It's the heart space that actually prompts me to move my hand down, pick this up, and offer it to somebody, right? In Eastern psychology, like Buddhist psychology, the motivation or the intention is a crucial part of the action. It's where the energy actually lies. It's where the distinction actually lies. It's where they say the karmic seed is planted, not in my arm. Because I could be offering you this for a thousand different reasons. You know, the karmic seed is planted in the intention behind the offering. Am I offering it to you because I like you, because I don't like you, because I want to embarrass you, because I want something in return? You know, so many possibilities. That's what distinguishes one act from a completely identical act on the surface. Okay, so we use mindfulness to see what our motive is, and sometimes it's very explicit. Like, you know, again, if I'm going into a company or an organization to teach, one of the things I sometimes say is, before a significant meeting or a phone call or something like that, just ask yourself, what do I want to see come out of this more than anything? Do I want to be seen as right? Do I want a resolution? Do I want to be helpful? Do I want to like grind them into dust? You know, it's just a way of taking a look. And that's just one of many ways of kind of sensing, where am I coming from? What's my motive in this? And that shows us a lot. It's also said that the arena of the psyche, of the mind, that a practice like loving kindness or any of these others affects the most is the field of motivation. So if, as an example, we have largely been motivated by fear in what we do or what we say or what we refrain from doing or saying, and we develop more loving kindness, we will find we are coming more and more from a place of connection. That's what's motivating us. The second part of an action is, you could say, the skillful or unskillful execution of the action. So I might think for a moment, maybe I'm coming from a really good and generous motive in wanting to offer you this, but I might think for a moment, probably useful to give him the bell too, right? Why just give him the striker? Or there are a lot of people in this room, maybe this is best done privately. Or whatever. You know, so it's discernment, it's mindfulness in a larger context. It's learning some skills. I was actually here in Seattle once when I heard the Dalai Lama speak, and he said something which just about had me rolling on the floor with laughter. He said something like, perhaps it's not so skillful to say it's cool in the room because maybe not everyone is feeling cool. Perhaps it's more skillful to say I am feeling cool. And the reason I was so amused was because I thought, oh, he sounds like every communications coach from California I've ever heard, right? Use I language, don't use you language. And first I thought, I wonder who he's been talking to, and then I thought, oh, he's probably been talking to communications coaches from California because he talks to all kinds of people. And I find there is a level of truth to that, right? And usefulness. So if, for example, you go to the movies with a friend and you walk out of the theater and you say that was the best movie ever made, there is now not enough room in the universe for someone to say I didn't like it that much. Whereas if someone says I love that movie, someone else might be able to say I didn't like it that much, and then a genuine communication can happen. Right, that's actually a dialogue, not someone declaring this is ultimately true. You know, like who cares what you think, right? So part of the reason it's a cliche and it's so used is that it actually works. Use I language, it's a skill. So we learn skills. That doesn't mean we're gonna be perfect, it doesn't mean everyone will be pleased with us. It means that we're growing, we're changing, we're using awareness in a bigger context to really do the best we can, right? So we have the motive, we have the skillfulness of the execution, and then we have the third aspect of the action is, you could say, the immediate result. Does someone thank you? Do they say, that's the best striker I've ever gotten? Maybe not, right? We can do the best we can and come from the best place we can come from with as much skill as we can figure out in that moment, but you cannot control the mood of the person who's going to walk in the door and receive your gift. Right? And that's where we need equanimity, meaning balance. Equanimity doesn't mean we don't care, it doesn't mean we give up, it doesn't mean we're apathetic, it means we have some perspective about things. And if you're trying to assess the integrity of your action, the recommendation is that you look back to your intention. Where was I coming from? And you look at the relative skillfulness of how you delivered that message or you delivered that gift. And beyond that, there's a kind of letting go, like, yeah, would that I were in control of the universe, and I'm not. Okay, so we'll go into this more as well, but that's how the development of the Brahmaviharas fit into our everyday actions and the things we do, the things we say. So the model in the Buddhist psychology is that each of these states is talked about: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. They're each talked about as having a far enemy, which is the clear opposite. Like, you'd never confuse the far enemy with the Brahmavihara state. They're each talked about as having a near enemy. And the near enemy is a state that's close enough so that on the surface you could easily get confused. And it takes a much deeper kind of look to understand the really essential differences between the two. And they're also talked about as having a proximate cause, which always amuses my friends in the legal profession, or I guess it's a term. The proximate cause is not the singular condition for the arising of the Brahmavihara state, but it's a good springboard. You know, it's a likely springboard for the arising or the strengthening of the Brahmavihara state. So the first is loving kindness, that sense of connection or friendship. I like connection with oneself, with others. It's a kind of beneficence. You're paying attention differently. So it's not only looking at what's negative, it's not only including some ultimately, or even just some aspects of ourselves. The far enemy of loving kindness is aversion, which in at least some schools of Buddhist psychology is anger or fear. It's the same mind state in two different forms, anger being the energized, outflowing form, fear being the held in, frozen form of wanting to strike out against what's happening, declare it to be untrue, like separate from it. So that's the clear opposite, right? With loving kindness, we're opening, we're connecting. With either anger or fear, we're pushing away or recoiling from. The near enemy, which tends to be, for each of these, kind of an interesting exploration, the near enemy is termed attachment. And as I said, maybe Friday night, it's confusing for us these days because of attachment theory in Western psychology. Attachment as the near enemy of loving kindness really means some effort to be in control. We're trying to hold on. There's more of a rigidity. That's where clinging and craving come in. It's like, may you be happy by Wednesday. I'm traveling Thursday. It's not a convenient day, so you've got to wrap it up by Wednesday. Or may you be happy in precisely this way. I have your list. Right? It's different than a freely given gift. Suddenly it's a gift with a lot of strings attached or a lot of expectation in there. And we know the difference, right? Because you can't control the outcome. So that's the place where I was saying, even though one can see loving kindness as a force, as an energy, you don't want it to fall into becoming attachment, because then you're judging yourself very severely. You know, they didn't get well in time for the graduation. It must be my metta is like nowhere, or whatever it might be. You know, that's very different than the freely given gift. May you be happy. Okay, the proximate cause of loving kindness, or a likely springboard, is twofold. One is looking for the good in someone. That doesn't mean you enter like La La Land and try to pretend not to see what might be real difficulty. It doesn't mean that you cease taking action to try to protect yourself or protect others. It means that if we obsess about and we only think about and we fixate on what's wrong with someone, we will naturally feel more and more and more alienated and less that our lives have something to do with one another. Now, there are times you cannot find any good in anybody, and that's the second reflection. But let's leave that aside for a moment. It's an interesting exercise, you know, even in a sea of difficulty, can you, and that might even be looking at yourself, can you find one good thing? So that was, it's like a preliminary reflection. So that was given to me when I went to Burma in 1985 to do 3 months of intensive loving kindness practice. And this is how I was describing myself before. My first thought was, I'm not going to do that. I thought, that's what stupid people do. They go around, they look for the good in everybody. Like, I don't even like people like that. I'm not going to do that. And then, you know, as I tell the story, I was very far from home. I was in a Burmese monastery. I was sort of determined to experiment and really be open. And the nature of the teacher-student relationship in a very traditional culture like that is not one where the teacher suggests you do something, you say, I don't feel like it. It's like, you do it. So I did it, and it was so interesting. Because I found it worked in just the way it was described to work. Not that I got all stupid and, you know, was trying to pretend everything was perfect, but that kind of obsession about this person being only one way forever, it couldn't thrive in that. And I even thought of somebody whose behavior I found extremely obnoxious in general, and I believe in a very, I think I was right, actually. But I had this memory, and I was there when it happened, you know, so it wasn't even like a story I heard, I saw it, where he did this incredibly kind thing for somebody, and he did it in the best way possible, so she didn't feel condescended to or put down in some way. He just did it beautifully, and that memory came back. And then I thought, I don't want to think about that. That complicates things. It was easier when he was all bad all the time. But you know what? Life is complicated. We're complicated. Everybody's complicated. So it just opened the door to that, even that consideration of how complicated we are, and therefore opened the door to loving kindness. Now, there are times you will not find one good thing about somebody. That's just the truth. And then the second reflection comes into play, which is kind of a tenet in Buddhist teaching that everybody wants to be happy. Everybody actually wants to be happy. And that's not a problem. We should be happy. The problem is the force of ignorance in that we usually don't have a clue what's really going to make us happy. And we're taught so many things that are so misguided, and we believe them, and we live our lives by them. If we accumulate endlessly, then we'll be happy. If we can only put everyone else down, then we'll be happy. Whatever it might be. And so the problem is ignorance, not that urge toward happiness. And if we can combine the urge toward happiness with wisdom instead of ignorance, then it's like a tremendous strength. Then we can cut through many obstacles. But we have to figure it out. The way the Dalai Lama said it, before his English got as good as it is, he said, if you're going to be selfish, in other words, if you want to be happy, if you're going to be selfish, be a wise selfish. Like, figure it out. Where's happiness really lying? So when we do that reflection, sometimes that can open the door to some loving kindness for someone, even a stranger, you know, whoever it is. And it was the poignancy I was talking about earlier, like, wow, if we all want to be happy, look at the path you chose. Wow, that's a life. You know, that's an awfully cut off life. That's an awfully small life, really. But wow. Okay, so that's loving kindness. Compassion is the second. Brahmavihara, the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's a movement of the heart, a movement toward to see if we can be of help. And as I said, probably Friday night, you can pursue each of these as a separate practice. They each have their own phrases, their own sequence. Or more commonly, we take one vehicle like loving kindness and we do all four within the one. But that option, those options do exist. So if you're offering loving kindness to a friend in trouble, it becomes like a compassion meditation as an example. So the far enemy of compassion is cruelty. It's the clear opposite of having your heart tremble in the presence of pain. I sometimes think of cruelty as such a powerful and consuming sense of otherness that what happens to the other, it sort of doesn't count. You know, it's like a piece of furniture or something like that, rather than a being who wants to be happy. And that's clearly the opposite. The near enemy is a little tricky to describe. Sometimes people say pity. It's not precisely pity exactly, because pity used to be, in earlier translations, it was like a good thing. It didn't have the associations we have with it now. Like now it would serve as a kind of near enemy, like being generous but with a little bit of an edge of contempt, or that hierarchical state, like I'm superior and you're inferior and I'm helping, you know. So that serves as a near enemy. The word that's commonly used in translations is sorrow or grief as the near enemy, but it doesn't mean grief in the Western psychological sense. It kind of means overwhelm. We would say burnout these days. This is probably the closest. So we are recognizing suffering as suffering. We're not pretending it's something else. We're not calling it something else. But somehow we don't have the wherewithal to move toward, to see if we can be of help. We're exhausted. We're depleted. We feel shattered, right? We feel overcome. So it's kind of looks like compassion on the surface, but when you really look, it's something else going on. That's why it's the near enemy. One scholar once suggested despair to me as the word. I think in real terms, in real life experience, we know it as burnout, you know, and so the common phrase in conventional language is compassion fatigue. In sort of some Buddhist circles, at any rate, they don't like that phrase because they don't think compassion can get fatigued. The suggestion has been to call it empathy fatigue. So that's the trajectory of that is especially in the work of Tanya Singer, who's a neuroscientist in Germany, who says she has differentiated the arena of the brain when we're feeling empathy from when we're feeling compassion. The idea is that empathy, which is that resonance, it's like the first part of the definition, you know, resonance with someone who's going through something, is a necessary but not sufficient condition for compassion to arise. It's like we need empathy. We need that kind of resonance, that sense, that vibing with someone like, ooh, that likely really hurts, right? But it's not enough. In psychological terms, they say we might feel that moment of empathy and then over-identify with the person. going through whatever. So it's not just kind of that likely hurts, but that could be me, and if it were me, it would be, you know. And in that case, they say empathy doesn't lead to compassion. It leads to empathic distress, where our own sense of distress becomes the most overwhelming thing happening. So the way I usually describe it is as a sequence of events. It's like, we need that empathy. This can be a cold country in a cold world, right? We can be very cut off. So we need some sense of empathy. But we might actually feel that and respond in lots of different ways. We might genuinely feel or sense that somebody's really hurting, and that might frighten us and we want to run away. Or we might feel blaming. You know, I gave you perfectly good advice 6 months ago. If you'd only listened to it, you'd be fine now. We might feel exhausted. We're so tired. It's too much. We might feel that kind of strange, over-heroic thing, like, I'm going to fix you by Wednesday, maybe Thursday, before I get on the flight. Right? Or we might have that moment of compassion as a response. For a while, I was trying to train myself not to say compassion, but to say the compassionate response, but it never worked. But now I'll say it. You know, the compassionate response is that movement toward, to see if we can be of help. It's not a movement into, to be burnt up, right? So what's the implication? Some spaciousness, some perspective, some equanimity, some stability, some resilience, some, you know, it's not just like crumbling, because if it were, we wouldn't be able to help anybody. We're just like, it's too much, right? So there are lots of states that are kind of implied as being present for it actually to be compassion that we're responding with. That's why I find it a very complex and interesting exploration. It's not so easy to really get what compassion is and why it's not diminishing and it's not exhausting in the form, in the way that the word is used, certainly in Buddhist psychology, which is why, you know, they laugh when you say compassion fatigue, because it's like, that's the remedy, you know? Like, say empathy fatigue, but for us it makes no difference, you know, because we say compassion fatigue as a ready term. But that's a very interesting thing to look at, because inevitably, somewhere in our lives, we are called upon to some kind of compassionate action. How much is that accompanied by equanimity, by balance? Compassion for ourselves as well as for someone else. Or compassion for someone in realizing, I can't fix it. You know, these are very powerful questions for us as human beings leading a life. The proximate cause of compassion is seeing suffering as suffering. So suffering doesn't have to mean like tragedy. You know, it can mean tragedy or trauma. It's also dissatisfaction, uneasiness, unsettledness. And you see, like, seeing suffering as suffering, starting with, for example, when you look at your own fear and you look at your own rage and you look at your own greed, rather than calling those states bad or wrong or terrible, what happens if you call them painful? That's a painful state. And watch what happens in your own mind in terms of your relationship when you re-term it in that way. It's interesting, right? It's not so much rejection, it's not so much feeling bad, but it's like, ooh, that hurts. That's the emergence of compassion. It's also true that we certainly don't all share the same measure of pain. But we do share that kind of vulnerability, because life can turn on a dime, and does. So that's part of the proximate cause, is realizing, look at how unsteady life is. Look at how changeable it is, that we're all so vulnerable. So there's that sense of more like being together rather than being so separate, which really helps the emergence of compassion. I'll probably go on this afternoon with sympathetic joy and equanimity. So is there anything you'd like to talk about at this moment? Oh!
Okay, sir. What do you suggest we do when we're greeted by homeless people who are begging for money on the street as you're passing by? And when you're at a red light and people are walking up and down the cars with signs?
Okay, what do I suggest one does when you're approached by homeless people begging for money, or if you're stopped at a red light and they're coming by with signs? You know, there is no formula. I know we would like a formula. From the point of view of what I was talking about earlier, the first thing is look at your motive, right? In giving or not giving. Like, where are you coming from? Which is part of seeing your worldview. Do you see that person as a person? Whatever you decide to do in terms of action, how are you looking at them? I've taught non-residential retreats, for example, in New York City, where we had to do all our walking meditation out on the street. And somebody said to me, you know, I gave this homeless guy $1 because that's my habit. I give them $1. And he said, it's the first time I ever looked anyone in the eye and realized that was a human being. Right? So that's the first question, is like, what's your intention? What's your motivation? What you do and what you don't do, I mean, there is no formula. You know, I know people, and part of it can be, if you wish, is undertaking a kind of experimental practice with the underlying intention to keep looking at your own mind, keep looking at your own reactions, keep looking at how things feel. So I know people who've undertaken the practice. For example, Bob Thurman is one example. He calls it his yoga, you know, where he teaches at Columbia University in New York, and there are a lot of street people as he walks to work. So he said at one point he decided that he was going to just put all these dollar bills in his pocket and he was going to give them out, but keep watching his own mind and how it felt in that relationship. And he said once he reached into his pocket and he'd inadvertently put in a $20 bill and he like handed it to the guy, and then he saw what he was doing and he was like, of course, very tempted to take it back, which he didn't, because he said, that was my yoga, you know. But the point is one's own awareness, you know, is to keep looking at how all these things feel. I know people, this one woman I was with once who's more coming from a place where she's very committed to her own sobriety. She was very concerned about perhaps helping somebody buy an intoxicant. So we were just coming back from dinner and this guy approached us and she said, I'm not going to give you any money, but I'm going to take you into the store and you can buy anything you want. And he, you know, he was like ecstatic, because if you know anything about that kind of life, the thing you don't have very much is choice. You don't get to say, I want broccoli on my pizza, right? Very often. So it was like this amazing moment. We just went into the store with him and he ordered a sandwich and he was beyond happy. She was beyond happy. Other people, you know, may have a different approach. So I can't say, you know, this is the right thing to do, but it's powerful. Like, you know, in contrast to her, I read about people who say, I'm just going to give them money. I don't care what they do with it. It's not up to me. But all of it is about our growing understanding and wisdom and how we relate. So it's a thing, you know. It's a real thing. Most profoundly based on how we see one another.
What you said earlier about sending your enemy and compassion was really helpful, because I watched that happen to me in the last couple of weeks. What's going on in the world that was really emotional, and I watched my sort of feelings of passion and sadness and wanting to do something convert to deep personal distress. And then I suddenly went from wanting to help to needing help.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you could speak a little more to if you see yourself in that spot, like what, from a practice perspective, what can I do? Because I realized the more compassion practice was like just spiraling down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you find you have moved to a place of deep personal distress, from a practice perspective, what can you do? Because more compassion practice toward the world is just spiraling down, and I think that's wisdom. It doesn't mean you're cold or you're callous or you're pulling back forever, but it is like both nurturing oneself and building up a kind of reservoir. Part of that is equanimity, realizing that truly life is a long-term thing, you know, in terms of the world. And I really do believe that we each need to do the good in front of us, however that appears to us to be. And there will be so many times when we don't see the result. But that doesn't mean nothing happened, right? We get so caught in wanting to see the result, which is logical, you know, it's reasonable. But really, things are happening in a much bigger time frame. Like, I had a young person come to one of my retreats. She was the daughter of a friend of mine. Maybe she was 15 at the time, something like that. And somebody asked a question about forgiveness. And this young girl raised her hand and she said, "Well, on whose time frame?" And I thought, "Ooh, that's so wise." Like, how'd you know that at 15? You know, and so that's not just making an excuse for oneself. It's like that's what equanimity shows us. It's a big picture. And sometimes we remind ourselves of that. But that is not the moment to stop doing the good in front of us. That releases us to do the good in front of us, whether it's in your neighborhood, your community, in your family, whatever. Because that's what we can do. And that's what can ripple out. There's nothing wrong with loving kindness for yourself. That's correct. Also, speaking about cliches, I was talking to a writer friend of mine, and I said, "You know what I can't even bear to use anymore is that example of, you know, you're sitting on an airplane and they make the safety announcements and they say if the oxygen mask descends, put your own on first before you try to help anybody else." And I said, I can't bear to use it. Like, everybody uses it. Every colleague I have uses it in talks. Every writing colleague I have uses it in writing. I said, I just can't use it. And she said, this friend I was talking to, who is a writer, she said, "You know, I was just on an airplane the other day, and they made that announcement, and the woman in the seat next to me said, I could never do that. I could never put my own oxygen mask on first." And I said, "Oh, maybe I can use it." You know, because it's still like intense and provocative and hard to grapple with. And, you know, but can you imagine, I would never do that, you know, and then you're like dying next to them. You know, like, please put your oxygen mask on so you can help me. You know, so it's not selfish. It's not meaning you're a coward, you know, you're avoiding suffering. It's like, I need some renewal. And out of that comes resilience. You know, so I'd say both things, like connecting to a bigger picture to the best of your ability and having some kind of self-care in that, which actually will give you the energy to kind of more completely connect again. Yes.
Right in the eye and wandering. Mm-hmm.
So now, if I've had two family members, how can I put this, are recovering heroin addicts.
Mm-hmm.
So now I know what people on meth look like, and I know what people on heroin look like. Okay, my question is, after seeing what this does to individuals, and I don't always have time to go to the store and get food or let them get whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What on earth should I do?
Well, I don't know what you should do in the moment. What I suggest you do is take that knowledge and wisdom and get involved in local government. I mean, there's a difference between an immediate response, which we need to have, right, to the request coming our way, and looking at systems change, right? And not everybody has that facility. I mean, I don't know what housing policy is in this town, you know? Clearly there's something going on. That's different than the decision to give somebody a dollar or not. You know, so if you have the personal experience, you have the personal pain, you have the wisdom of at least some dimension of the problem, look for a way to plug into systems change. But I don't know in terms of, you know, that person. I mean, this is a very interesting question in terms of good-heartedness, you know, because it's its own skill. It's its own kind of ability to do an analysis. You know, I don't know how many people confronted by a homeless person. I was just the other night, you know, it was in my hotel, there wasn't room to eat in the restaurant, and so I sat outside, and there I was, outside, right? There you go. Not everybody is gonna have the ability to make the leap to what is housing policy in this town, or what is the emphasis in terms of drug treatment? Is it punishment or is it treatment? I don't know. And some people can put their hearts there, they can put their effort there, so I suspect you're one of them. Yeah. Yeah. So the comment was that when I use that model of motivation, discernment of skillfulness or unskillfulness, and then the immediate response, sometimes we also misinterpret the response or the reaction. I use the example of sometimes once he was given a gift, which he actually really appreciated, but he was a little puzzled by how to use it, so the look on his face probably gave the impression that he didn't really like it much, but that wasn't what he was trying to convey. And we can all be, we can recognize that scenario both from when we've tried, you know, we've been giving the gift, and when we've received the gift. So that's also a call for not rushing to judgment. You know, that was a waste, or whatever it might be. Okay, specific approaches to compassion practice. Again, there's kind of a choice. You can continue on using the same phrases, doing loving kindness in effect, but specifically bring up recipients whom you know are suffering. And you might do that reflection on their vulnerability and our shared vulnerability, which is the proximate cause. So that's one choice, and it's fine. Some of it depends on the kind of mind you have, like, you know, what happens if you switch phrases? Are you just going to be confused? Or is that a fine thing to do? What length of time are you talking about making the switch, and so on? There are compassion phrases, just as there are loving kindness phrases, and there's also freedom within the choice of the compassion phrase, just as there's freedom within the choice of the loving kindness phrase. The classical phrase for compassion is something like, may you be free of pain and sorrow, right? May you be free. Some people don't like that because it sounds too attached to outcome. I like it, you know, partly because I always practiced with very classical phrases, so I got to have a deeper and deeper experience of them. Like, in my mind, being free of doesn't mean it disappeared as an experience. It means you're free, right? But I can understand the objection a lot of people have, and so sometimes they change it to, like, I care about your pain and sorrow, or, you know, there are lots of options for, you know, the idea is that you're kind of particularly tuning into that vulnerability and that tenderness around life that we all share, and so the response that's being elicited is slightly different than the loving kindness. You know, it's not divorced from it, but it's got its own sort of flavor over time. So you could do that, and in all of those change, you know, if we're shifting phrases, because you want to sort of undertake the other Brahmavihara more completely, then the basic principle still applies, which is you're trying to do it in the easiest way possible. So the first object or recipient in compassion practice is usually someone who's clearly suffering. And not a composite, not like my sense of a homeless person in Seattle. You know, it's a real being. Unless, I mean, if you know the homeless person or you've seen them, or that's different, you know. So it's some real being that whose suffering is very apparent to you. That's the first object. So you switch the sequence along with switching the phrases, just in alignment with that sense of doing it the easiest way possible. It's all in my book, Loving Kindness, by the way. Yeah. The question was, or the point was about sometimes struggling with the right person to focus on or the right group to focus on. Doesn't matter. It really doesn't. Everything's complex. Everything brings its own challenges. You know, you find the benefactor, it seems perfect, and then you do remember, oh, you know, there was that one time. You weren't really there for me, or what about that other friend? I'm leaving them out. Or it's really, you know, we have an unfolding of the practice in a systematic way for the sake of concentration. You know, not because you're really ultimately leaving this being out, or, you know, you need to find the perfect benefactor. You just do what you can. And if you find, like, a tremendous challenge, it's just overwhelming, then you switch, you know, switch to somebody else. Or, but it's almost like everyone is representational. You know, it's symbolic of a certain kind of relationship. Okay, so anger is the energy that pushes you to do something about something like inequality or something. So, yes, that's often the case. In the Buddhist psychology, anger is described as being like a forest fire which burns up its own support. So it has the potential to destroy us as the host. It also, like a forest fire, might burn kind of wild and leave us in a place we don't really want to be. It's like, I don't think there are many people, there might be some, and you might be sitting here, who cannot remember a single time where you don't now have regret about something you said or did out of anger. That looking back, you think, well, I wish I had taken that energy and responded differently. I mean, I certainly do, right? So it's not that anger is sort of condemned, you know, because it does have that energy, which is a very positive part. But when you really look at its nature, it's got a lot of other things too, you know? It's got that self-destructive quality. It's got part of the positive part of the energy is that can help us cut through, like social niceties or things like that, and somebody saying, hey, look at that, which no one wants to look at. But anger also can be filled with a kind of delusion because it gives us tunnel vision, right? So in the example I used the other day, like think about the last time you were really angry at yourself, like really angry at yourself. And bring it up right now. Is that also a time when you're likely to think, you know, I did those five great things the same morning?
No.
Like those five great things, they're gone. All we have is that I'm an idiot. I can't believe I, you know, did that. Right? The story I usually tell about it is I was... This was a long, long time ago when I was first using email. And it was so exciting to hear that sound, you know, like, I've got an email. And I was at home in Barrie. I was working on my desktop, and I heard that sound. And it was an email from somebody saying to me, I don't understand what the problem with anger is. So it's not considered a problem to feel it. That's another distinction. It's often a problem if we're acting on it, if that's our motivation, right? Or a singular motivation. If we're overwhelmed by it, right? We feel what we feel. That's just what happens. But so I don't understand what the problem is with anger. So I wrote back and I said, well, one of the problems is that when we're overwhelmed with anger, we tend to put people in a box. And then I got offline and I was working on some project when something went terribly wrong in the relationship between my computer and my printer, and I got really angry. So the first person I got angry at, this was so long ago, we didn't have the phrase IT, we had a computer assistant. I got really angry at our computer assistant because he wasn't there, he was on vacation in Hawaii. I was furious. Totally forgetting that the reason he was on vacation was that I had decided he needed a vacation. And the reason he was in Hawaii was that I had gone to the airport and used my frequent flyer miles to get him a ticket. That was gone, right? I was just consumed with the, you're never here when I need you kind of feeling. And I got down on my hands and knees and I'm like pulling out plugs and putting in other plugs. And the next person I was really angry at was myself. Why don't you ever learn about these things? You don't know how to fix anything. You're so inept, you know. In the meantime, I fixed it, but I hardly even took a moment to appreciate that because I was so angry at myself. So I got back up on my chair and I was working on the thing and then I heard that sound again. And so I went to the email and there was my original correspondent saying, I don't understand what you mean by saying that when you're lost in anger, you just put people in a box. So I wrote to him and I said, this is what just happened. I put this other person in a box. You're never there when I need you. I put myself in a box. You can't fix anything, right? So that's not to say we shouldn't feel what we feel. We do feel what we feel, whatever that is. How are we going to relate to it is the big question. And in some schools, they would say, can you pick that energy up without the rest? You know, the tunnel vision and the burning and the damage and all of that. That's a big question. Oh, yes.
I've always been particularly interested in the mirror image.
Yeah.
It's happening. And it seems to me that one of the best antidotes is a modicum of self-confidence.
Uh-huh.
So that you're not always assuming that the person who didn't smile at you doesn't like you. But how do these...
how do the Brahma Viharas feed into self-confidence?
Yeah.
Okay, so how do the qualities like loving kindness and compassion feed into self-confidence? Well, loving kindness is considered the direct antidote to fear. So let's look at a possible relationship between fear and a lack of self-confidence. It seems likely that you can draw that line, right? Self-confidence, you know, in kind of the Buddhist world would be sort of like self-respect. And it's considered a good thing. It's not like, hey, you know, I'm like great or better than anybody else. You know, but it's a kind of self-respect. And there's something very important about self-respect, actually, which isn't always so popular. I mean, that's one of the reasons we're urged to practice morality and ethics. Because if you're going around feeling miserable about yourself all the time and paranoid, like, did I lie enough? Did I lie to the right people? You know, maybe I have to tell another lie to bolster the earlier lie. You're going to feel really crummy about yourself. And it's not a great energy to then try to practice meditation, as an example, you know? Because you're going to feel like, you know, so distracted and so distressed that it would be another example of trying to do something in the hardest way possible. You know, so, and generosity is talked about in the same way, that there's a kind of joy that comes from generosity, which is that same sense of, like, self-respect. Like, I did the best I could, you know, or I really opened, or something like that. And fear would seem to be the opposite. You know, we can create a life that's very fear-based. I mean, even aside from fearful things that happen anyway. But if you're that paranoid is not probably the right word. If you're that concerned about the thing you're smuggling across the border, it's not going to be easy, you know? And we understand that, you know, that we can craft a life that is kind of fearless to the best of our ability in terms of what we're creating. And compassion and self-respect, or, you know, self-confidence in the word that you used, I think it does actually in a very funny way in that there's a part of like Kristen Neff's system around self-compassion that's called common humanity, where like I blew it, I made a mistake, I did this thing. That's a part of life. It's not just me. You know, this is part of the human condition. We make mistakes. We have to start over again and again. whatever it might be. And somehow that kind of extension to a feeling like you belong in a larger picture of life, I think actually also helps with that kind of debilitating habit of, like, I'm the worst person that's ever lived, or God knows I'm the worst meditator that's ever lived, you know? And so, you know, people have done this for 2,600 years, but it's hit a wall in me because I can't keep my mind on my breath or whatever we usually do, you know? So I think it is a distinction from that. Nice. So the comment was, what's that? Oh, yeah. A statement that when she makes a mistake, especially monetary, she has a saying she uses, which is, this is just tuition in the college of life. So, that's good. Anybody else? Yes.
Sometimes a purification practice, and I feel like I've never heard you talk about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Is it something? Is that an aspect of the practice that you teach, or that you consider like?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the comment was about hearing a lot of teachers talking about the Brahmavihara practices as purification practices, and which I don't tend to say. And so, do I? What do I think? Yeah, I think. I think all practice is really purification, and it's maybe most in the sense that a lot comes up, and that's not a bad sign. You know, like when I describe myself as first doing mindfulness practice and all this anger was coming up, and I thought it was a terrible sign, you know, like, oh, I'm so much worse than when I came to India, you know, which was a mistaken notion, but sometimes beautiful, wonderful, amazing, pleasant experiences happen in practice, sometimes very painful. Emotions and memories and all kinds of things come up. It's all natural, you know, it's all part of it. And so practice is often described as a purification process to kind of remind us that you haven't gone off the rails, you know, and it's not like some hideous thing. Everything depends on how you're relating to what comes up. How much presence, how much balance, how much compassion can you bring forth in response to what's arising? And that will mean different things at different times, because balance is a tricky thing. It's not static. You know, sometimes balance comes from hanging in there. Sometimes balance comes from taking a break. You know, so how you respond can be guided differently, but it's the response that's really the point. The Brahmavihara practices are kind of most ironically a purification process in that the same kinds of things inevitably come up. Anger, grief, you know, all kinds of things. And at the same time, you're saying, may I be happy? Or it's even worse, like if you do it classically, there are 11 benefits that are said to come from doing loving kindness practice. And in a place like Burma, you hear that recited out loud all the time, and you yourself are encouraged to begin each sitting with a recitation of these 11 benefits because it's inspiring. But they start with, you sleep easily, you wake easily, you have pleasant dreams. People love you, and I can go on from there because I actually think I can do all 11 still. But, you know, maybe you had like the worst nightmares of your life when you were on retreat, because that happens too, right? And then you have to get up and you say, you sleep easily, you wake easily, you have pleasant dreams. Like, you know, but the kind of ultimate benefit is different than the purification process, which is inevitably a part of it. You know, so it's not meant to be like, oh, the whole world has pleasant dreams but me, you know, when I do metta. It's like, this is just the process. It happens, yeah.